Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to Meet the Author on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Denny Griffin. For the next 45 minutes, I'll be your host. And tonight, my guest is Los Angeles County Deputy District Attorney and author Robin Sachs. Robin specializes in prosecuting sex crimes against children. For over 15 years, she has prosecuted some of the most despicable defendants who committed the most heinous crimes. In her latest book, Predators and Child Molesters, Robin answers the 100 most asked questions by parents about how they can protect their children. Robin, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be on.
If I said that this book was timely, it might be an understatement. it's really incredible. And I've read the book, and I've learned an awful lot. My education is continuing into this whole thing about predators and molesters and abusers and all that. And it's much worse than I had ever thought, as far as I'm concerned. And certainly a book like this was needed, I believe, because I feel very strongly the public has to be educated as part of the battle against these individuals. And I think certainly your book is a great step in that direction. So thank you for writing it.
Well, I really appreciate that. It was my honor and pleasure to write it. And I totally agree with you that it really was clear that it needed to be done.
Let me just, before I forget, give out the phone number in case anyone has a question or comment for Robin. You can reach us at 646-478-0982, 646-478-0982. And Robin, now when did you actually start the manuscript? When did you start writing this book?
Well, actually, it was kind of an interesting story, and it kind of came full circle for me as of last Friday, but really actually in reality last night. A year ago, almost to the day, a week ago, last Friday, I was in my office and a young lady, or young girl rather, at the young age of 12 years old, was at the hospital up the street. And she had just disclosed to her mother that she had been touched by her longtime English as a second language teacher. And how the disclosure came about was that she was doing a simple extra credit homework assignment, did a Google search, and inadvertently hit a website that ended up being a pornographic website. And her reaction was so negative and vile that the disclosure just came pouring out of her mouth. And following that disclosure and then the investigation, in the course of a weekend, and it's not very often that I can say this, but it certainly was an example of the case being handled absolutely impeccably by Santa Monica Police Department. The DA's office handled it appropriately. The judges handled it appropriately. But the one thing that I saw was very shortly following the disclosure and prior to the charges being filed, on the Monday, the Santa Monica Lincoln Middle School held a town hall meeting for the parents to be able to address the catastrophe that had just gone, and they were looking for information as to what was going on with the case. And at that moment, I knew in my mind's eye that the case was going to be filed. I knew the charges. I knew the evidence that we had. But I wasn't at that point at liberty to say anything in an open public forum. And as we were answering questions in the most, you know, innocuous way possible, a grumbling, which later turned to a roar, broke out amongst the parents in the back corner of the room, where they began chanting, "Not guilty," and rallying around the defendant. And I sat there in awe thinking, here we are in a case and there's kind of no facts and no information that has been given, yet parents preferred to believe that it didn't happen as opposed to it did happen. So in my mind I thought, okay, there are three possibilities. Either these people are just the meanest, cruelest individuals anybody could ever meet, or two, they were simply naive, or three, that they were just completely in denial. And I decided to go with the naive and in denial and decided, you know what, I hope none of those parents have kids that come disclosed to them, because those parents won't believe their children and they will sit there and fall prey. And if there was any reason why children wouldn't tell the parents, who had nothing to do with the case and had no knowledge of the case, were ostracizing this poor girl. And it cemented in my fact that these are smart, educated people who simply didn't know the facts. And I decided that I was going to change that. And instead of, you know, I did a Google search following the that meeting, saying, you know, asking, you know, how do you know if a child's telling the truth? And I started listing kind of the questions, if I was in the parent, what questions I would want to know to look up information. And what I found was that there was not one website online that had every question in one place. There was, you know, some good sites that had, like, you know, the frequently asked questions, and maybe you had a, you know, top 10 questions, you had a couple, you know, key questions answered here or there, but there wasn't anything that went from prevention through prosecution that was just the straight nothing but the facts, ma'am. And that was what I was going to provide. And so I was in the middle of writing another book, actually several other books, and I called my publisher and I said, okay, I'm sorry to do this to you, but how fast can a book go to print? And I need to write this book, and it needs to be in softback so that everyone can afford it, and it needs to be out, you know, in the marketplace, like, before my case is done. And it didn't quite get there before it was done, because fortunately the defendant in that case pled guilty to each and every count. He admitted to every single act. He he's spending 14 years in state prison, which could be the rest of his life, because he's an old man with heart problems. So it was, you know, that case that brought it to fruition. And yesterday I went to dinner with the victim's mom, who asked me to, you know, autograph the book, and she said that she had been reading it, and she said, you know, the thing that's so depressing to her, what she thought was depressing, was that she was reading the book, having been through sexual assault, she realized that there were still so many things she didn't know. And so even people who have been through the system, even people who spend their life through it, and it reminds me, like, I need to reread this for myself, because you forget, you know, you don't realize certain things, and so it's not meant to belittle anyone or make anyone feel dumb. It's to empower them and to empower our children.
Well, it's certainly, as I said, needed and well-timed, and it was quite a team effort between you and the publisher and so forth to get this out in a very expedited fashion. So that a good publisher to work with, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, kudos to them. They really did see the need right away and let me go forward with it and let me take the lead, and they made it happen. And then now, and actually the companion book, which was the book that I was in the beginning of at the time that they let me delay my deadline on, was the next one coming out, which is Inside the Life of a Sex Crimes DA. And that's the one where I really kind of lambast the system and talk about what I would do differently. So that's to be discussed at another time.
Okay. Would you mind, Robin, you know, I don't want to give too much of the book away, but I want to discuss some of the things in it. So would you object if I read some things from the book?
Oh, absolutely not. No, this is meant to be shared amongst everyone in whatever format.
Okay. This, for example, let's just discuss in the content some of the parts of the book. Part 1, Recognizing the Predators, Molesters, Pedophiles, and Opportunists. Now, I didn't realize until I read this book that there are differences. I kind of lumped everybody together, but there are differences, aren't there, between these various actors?
There are. There are different technical terms depending on who is describing them. They're very much used interchangeably. I use them interchangeably personally, but they actually do, each word has their own special meaning. And the one that's kind of most surprising is pedophile. In order to be a pedophile, you actually have to have a ongoing relationship involving a 12, I'm sorry, you would have a relationship that would last over a period of 6 months where there is the urges and fantasies. Now, to me, you know, if someone even once was a, you know, say a 50-year-old man and was interested in a 4-year-old child, I don't, you don't need 6 months of fantasies to call that person in my book a pedophile.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the DSM, which is the Psychological Bible, and how the terms are defined, there is a specific term, as is the term opportunist and predator and so forth.
It's another question nine in part one. Sort of, what does a molester look like? And, you know, that's really a difficult proposition. I mean, there is no standard that all molesters look the same, right? They can be the what we consider the scumbag type. Or they can be professional people. I mean, you don't necessarily know when you pass them on the street.
Correct. There's no physical look. There's some character observations that people can make, and there's some qualities that these people have, or lack of quality, if you want to call it what it really is, that are consistent, but not necessarily. I mean, people can fit in any sort of visual profile. It's how they act in a mental way.
Okay, Robin, let me interrupt for just a second here. We have a caller on the line. Let me see what the question is. 503 area code, you're on the line. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Danny. It's Karen.
Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Welcome.
Hey, Robin.
Hi, Karen. How are you?
Fine. My mom's sick, so I'm like in her room. I'm hiding in the closet, so don't say a bad word.
Okay, I promise you.
Just kidding.
I know. I know. I'm on Denny's show, so I'll be on my back.
I know. I'm just kidding. I just wanted to tell you my daughter got the book, and she started reading it. Of course, she didn't get a lot of time with the two, but she said it was great. It was just wonderful.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, she said she just didn't have any idea, you know, all the different ways that they, you know, these predators get around.
It is mind-boggling. I mean, it really is. And, you know, I'm here in Los Angeles, and I was talking to a group of people today, and I was saying, you know, if you don't believe me in terms of the prevalence, let me just tell you, I'm one person in, you know, one county that has 1,200 other DAs, and when I wasn't on leave in my DA's office, I reviewed at least two or three new cases a day, and that didn't even cover the entire county. And it's mind-boggling if you think about and multiply that throughout the country and each county. And those are just the people who are disclosing.
It makes me wonder who's raising our kids.
Well, I think that the first thing is, I think that this subject is very interesting. I will, you know, for example, talk to people and get pitched to go speak to groups of people, and very often the organizers for speeches or organizers for television and organizers for those kinds of things say, oh, God, this is just too rough of a subject. We don't want to talk about it. And that's what the media...
Well, MTV is fine, right?
Right, and that's what's... And it's interesting to me. It's like, how can we not talk about it? You know, the television, there's not, you know, I was talking to producers about crime shows, and even, you know, and we love Nancy Grace and we love these shows, but, you know, they spend time talking about blood, guts, and murder, but you really hear about the ins and outs. I mean, we should be knowing way more about the Huckabee case, and that case kind of has already been glossed over, at least, you know, for now. And I want to know, you know, about the sexual assault, because how we can make these conversations normalized and give children the power is to be able to begin having the conversations in just regular day life and looking for those teachable moments.
Right. Well, thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Karen, thank you
bye-bye.
For calling.
You're welcome. Karen. Bye.
Bye-bye. We had a little trouble with my chat room here to begin with. We're starting to get some activity there now, Robin, and we may get some questions there. I'll keep an eye on it. See if,
For some reason, I've been having a tough time with the chat room, too. So.
Frustrating, isn't it?
I know. Trust me.
So I won't ask you to comment here, but I just want to mention a couple of the other things covered in part one. What is grooming? Where do molesters seek their victims? Why are children susceptible to sexual abuse? Where do molesters live? Interesting question. And why do people molest? So there's all kinds of important topics in here. My theory is that you don't have to be a parent with young children to be interested in this, because I think most of us, if we're past the young children stage as parents, or were never married or never had children, we may have younger sisters or brothers. I guess, you know, boys can be molested too. And we have nieces, nephews, friends, and just as good neighbors. I think we all have some responsibility to kind of keep an eye on things if we can.
Absolutely. And not to mention, in terms of educating ourselves, one of the things that I talk to parents about is we shouldn't expect kids to necessarily disclose to the parent. It's really hard for a child sometimes to come forward from shame, embarrassment, and also to protect the parent from harm. And any one of us, any adult, can be that trusted adult to another child. And what we do and how we react is so critical in terms of not only the child's experience, but in terms of an investigation, how a case is handled, the success of prosecution. And since my number one objective is to get these cases prosecuted so these bad guys go away for long periods of time and get them off the street, those are really critical messages that everyone needs to know. I mean, what happens if you're walking down the street and you see, observe something happen? You know, what are our responsibilities? What kind of things? I mean, people sometimes feel like, the benefit of the doubt should be given to an adult or given, that must not be, and we doubt our instincts. But my book and my message is we need to be a proactive society. We need to be empowered. Our children need to be empowered, and we all should be aware.
And, people who think, and I believe they are deceiving themselves, if they think that law enforcement has the resources, including personnel and equipment, to monitor every website, 24/7, be at every school, be where they should be to keep an eye on kids and so forth, that just isn't going to happen. If we as the public don't participate, the molesters are going to win.
Absolutely. I mean, it's kind of going back to the neighborhood watch basic kind of, it takes a village mentality. If we all need to watch out for each other, we all need to watch out and care for our young, and we all need to take responsibility in our own community policing, because it's not happening through law enforcement. I mean, the cops are called and deal with the crimes once they've already been committed. At that point, the damage is done, and that's their role. The idea is just to stop the damage or prevent the damage from ever occurring.
And I just want to quickly move into part two and some of the questions that you answer there. How often should I talk to my children about preventing sexual abuse? How can I teach my kids about personal safety without scaring them? Is it okay to tell my children news stories about sexually assaulted children? And here's one that's something: are internet predators different from other predators, and why are they so successful? Now, that's just a few of the questions answered in part two. And the internet, that's certainly an interesting issue. I don't know what some of these people did before they had the internet. What was the old Smith Barney commercial? We did it the old-fashioned way.
Right.
The internet certainly, I mean, there's a lot of good things about the internet, certainly, because I'm on it. I spend about half my time on it. But there are some drawbacks to the internet, and besides spam mail. And I think this predator thing, or this is part of that. Do you agree that it opened up a great opportunity for the bad guys?
Well, I think that, first of all, the internet is here, and the internet is here to stay. And just like with the invention of the car, the phone, and any other sort of modern technology, everyone had this fear that, our children, our world is going to go to hell in a handbasket with these new inventions. And as we see, the phone and the car has stayed, and the internet will stay too, and it's a wonderful resource. And really what we need to think about is it's not about punishing our children and preventing them from utilizing this wonderful resource because of the behaviors of others. What instead it is that we need to educate our children about this as being a different point, a different portal of access that predators can use and abuse, unfortunately. And I have very specific techniques that I do mention in the book in terms of how what types of things we need to do on the internet, but my one message that I really would want to get out to your listeners would be, when a kid comes forward and discloses that they got an unwanted message, it's so often the parent's first reaction is to punish the child by saying, oh, my God, okay, you have to get off that website or get off the computer. And the child has now gotten penalized for doing exactly what we want the child to do, and that's to come forward and disclose. And instead, we should be honoring our child and saying, thank you so much. I'm so proud of you for recognizing that dangerous situation. And the real answer is simply to delete. Children a lot of times think that they can outsmart perpetrators by engaging in conversations, or they'll even say, you know, no, I don't want to talk to you or whatever. But the second they respond, it opens a conversation when they really should just delete the message and let the perpetrator go on its way.
Yeah, once you open the door, then it can lead to other difficulties, right?
That's right. I mean, once the conversation ensues, all it takes, and that's the thing, is that predators give what kids crave, and that is their undivided attention. They spend the time to learn what hobbies they like, what movies are cool, what lingo's going on. They spend the time paying attention and listening, and children want to be heard. And the only people who seem to be listening to children are our perpetrators. We should be utilizing the same techniques that the perpetrators use to be able to prevent sexual assault and victimization and beat them at their own game.
Let me just stop for a second here. We do have another call on the line. Let's see what we... Hi, caller, you're on the line. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Hi, this is Dr. Jan.
Hi, Doc.
Hey, I was agreeing with Robin because I was going to say the same thing, but also we need to get the children to tell if somebody says, don't tell your parents or I'm going to hurt you type mentality, how they scare these children. When they do sexually assault these children, they'll tell them, don't tell anybody, it's just between you and me. We have to get these children to tell us. Do you agree
Absolutely.
With that?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what the goal is, and as parents, as adults, it's our job to listen, and our first instinct needs to be to believe. The normal instinct is to not believe and to deny and to minimize and blame or do any of those cycle of violence kinds of behaviors. But what we need to do is we need to honor our children and thank them for telling. And it doesn't need to be specifically to the person you would prefer that they tell. For example, a child, I would love for my kids to know that they could come to me first. But if they went to my sister, who I trust and know is a safe adult, then that's okay too. And that's what the message that we want kids to have is that they can find their trusted adult and that they will be listened to, heard, and believed.
And my other thing is being that, you know, in the medical field, I have seen a lot of children who it's the mommy's new boyfriend.
Yes.
And the mommy does not believe them.
Absolutely.
It just irritates the living daylights out of me.
Oh, it's disgusting.
When they come in. And they'll pick the child over the, they'll pick the boyfriend over the child because she's giving him money or providing her a place to live, so forth.
Absolutely, and worse than that, you see also is that they'll blame the child for being overly flirtatious and stealing their boyfriend from them. I've seen that as well.
Yeah, and which I find that very hard to believe when a 4-year-old is being molested. How she can entice a man. Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Well, that in my opinion, I've prosecuted mothers who have not protected their for failure to protect. I don't think enough DAs do that. Situations where parents don't come forward and do what's necessary to protect their child should not have parental rights. They don't get that privilege in my book.
Yeah, I agree. Well, thank you.
Thank you for calling.
Thanks for the call, Doctor. That reminds me, last night, I was mentioning to you earlier, Robin, Mark Klass was on, and one of the topics, one of the questions that came up was about, well, I guess it depends on the jurisdiction, what they call an order of protection, mm-hmm. in some places a restraining order, that what a lot of times let's assume that the majority of the times it's the female half getting the protection, and they don't stick to their guns necessarily. The abuser or potential abuser comes in with a bouquet of flowers or takes her out to dinner or that type of thing, and all of a sudden they're back in the house. Is that accurate in your opinion? Do you think sometimes the mother will, for a while, be ticked off and then want to resolve the problem, but then can be talked out of it?
I think the same psychological factors that exist in domestic violence do present themselves in sexual assault as well. Beyond just the mother falling into the trap of re-entering the cycle of violence and returning to their, boyfriend, husband, whomever was the one who was the abuser, I've also seen children, feel very conflicted and be very upset, but yet not want the perpetrator punished. And it's a little bit of a different dynamic. I had actually a case. It was really troubling to me. I was in the middle of a jury trial. It was actually not biological father. It was stepfather who was molesting his 13-year-old and 10-year-old daughters, and one daughter over a longer period of time than the other. And then the younger one was maybe there was one or two isolated instances, and we caught on and it was disclosed before it went any further. But after she testified and was subject to cross-examination, and I'm talking grueling 6 hours of cross-examination, which is one full court day of just cross-examination, she got off of the stand, walked down to the defense counsel's table where her defendant stepdad was sitting, and gave her dad a hug in front of the jury. And, for a second, I'm mortified as the prosecutor. I'm like, oh, no, what does this mean? What are they going to think? Are they not going to believe her? Whatever. But I think it really showed the conflict and the difficult. There's an aspect of sexual abuse in a child's mind that it's not all bad. Some of it has provided them attention. Some of them has made them physically feel good, which they feel a lot of guilt about. Some of them don't understand why, if they agreed to something, why the person's getting in trouble. And that's a little bit different than the cycle of violence of I'm so being controlled. That's just the immaturity that goes along with being a child. Thus, the reason why we as adults need to protect children even more, because the reason why we have the laws that we do is they are not in the position to be able to take care of themselves. That's why we don't let children vote and drive until they reach a certain age, because they make poor choices. And so it's a very conflicting situation. And parents and mothers who go back and violate the protective orders do a triple disservice to their kids than they've already done.
What can be done, if anything, to a mother who is aware that their child is in a dangerous situation and takes the child or allows the child to re-enter that situation? I guess it depends on the jurisdiction, but certainly they've not only made a poor judgment but endangered the welfare of the child if they had reason to believe the child was in danger and they subject the child a second time or a third time to the danger, then they can be prosecuted as well as the offender.
Right. Well, the thing that needs to be, that actually is kind of makes the case even easier for the prosecutor. If there has been a report and then the mother, and there's a protective order in place, and then a mother or anybody allows access, that's pretty, you can no longer say, well, I didn't know he was doing it. You were there at the court case. We had you there. There was a protective order. You were in court. We can do all of that stuff. To ensure that they've been on notice. One of the most difficult things is the argument, oh, I never knew this was going on, so how was I supposed to stop it? So it actually makes it for a cleaner case. And I have to say, at least here in California, the Department of Children and Family Services, when we have an actual prosecution going on, my social workers are phenomenal about making sure that the mothers are toeing the line whether they want to or not. Because they'll remove the kids right there in the middle of the case if they're not bringing the kid to court when they're supposed to or participating in the way that they're supposed to.
Well, that's good, because I've heard some horror stories, whether they're totally true or not, I don't know, but about some of these child protective services in different states that allegedly don't take their jobs real seriously and allow things to go on that probably shouldn't. So if you have a real good child protective service, it's got to be a real comforting feeling to know that there's people out there taking these children out of danger.
Right, and it's not perfect, trust me, let me tell you. I mean, it takes vigilance. It's far from perfect. But if you have a good team, and I talk about the team working together, and people, and if everyone has the passion that you have, the passion that I have, and really makes it their business and makes it makes themselves accessible to each other, then it works. I get calls, you know, and I'm on leave right now from the DA's office, and I still get calls from social workers saying, hey, what do I do on this case? And I'm not going to say, oh, sorry, I'm on leave. Call me in September, you know, when I come back or whatever. I will handle the situation, you know, anytime. And there are other people like that. Unfortunately, there's not enough of us who, you know, dedicate their life, you know, to, you know, this area. And that's kind of another argument that I make, is that I think that only people who want to be doing these kinds of crimes should be doing it. If you don't have the passion for it, prosecutors should be doing dope sales, go do some burglaries and robberies or something else. You got to have the stomach and the passion. Our kids depend on us.
Yeah, and speaking of that, with the commitment and the interest in doing what you can to fight the problem, how tough is it on someone like you emotionally? I mean, is it, you know, with the stuff you see or hear and so forth, does it take a toll on you?
Well, you can't. I'd be lying if I didn't say it did. I have three children myself, and they all, you know, let's put it this way. My daughter has accompanied me to the police station many of times when it's been necessary, you know, on a Saturday. My family is affected by what I do. So, yes, I, you know, when and before my kids were old enough to talk, it was really hard for me, picking caregivers out and knowing that my kids were safe. So I have all of the same fears as a parent that any other person does. And let me tell you, I'm not perfect. You know, I'm busy, and, you know, my daughter is sitting here right now as we speak, following me around the house, writing me notes, asking me to, you know, pay attention to her right now, and I'm giving her my 1 minute finger, and, you know, so, you know, it's this is in real time. I mean, it's really happening at this exact moment. So yes, we're all busy. So I'm not any better than anybody else. I make the same mistakes. I, you know, have failed to give the correct talk in a safety moment. And I just, you know, kind of pinch myself now saying, God, now, thank goodness I wrote this, because now people are watching to make sure I'm doing my job.
Before we move on to the next topic here, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you to please give out any website information or where people can get your book and so forth.
Thank you. My website is www.robinsax.com. And my book is also available on Amazon and all the regular venues, Borders, Barnes & Nobles, and that kind of thing.
Question, is there somewhere people could order, like, say, through your website to get an autographed copy if they wanted one, or do they need to come to a book signing, or how does...
Anybody who wants an autographed copy, feel free to email me at robin@robinsax.com. I send them out. I have a... You know, I think I've bought more copies of my book than any author will ever buy. I have 400 of them sitting in my living room. My husband would be thrilled to get them out of there. So, no, I'm happy to send autographed copies. It's my honor. And I also, for anybody who does have a foundation and a charity that they would like me to send a copy to, I send gratis free copies out all the time in big numbers. You know, if you let me know where you think someone should have it, I'm happy to send it out.
Okay, thank you very much. Move on to part three of your book. And question 33 is the first one in that particular part. Should I report a suspected child abuser to the police, or do I need tangible evidence? Now, without asking you or just reading your answer, I thought about that before I read the book. I was wondering, I said, you know, if somebody spots something they think isn't quite right, for example, I'm a parent, I got a 5 or 6 year old daughter, and the neighbor from down the street starts kind of hanging around, wanting to do odd jobs at the house, you know, yard work or that type of thing, an adult male. And there's this, you know, the old, you know, the hunch thing, the gut feeling that something isn't quite right. Maybe he's seems to want to be out in the yard when your daughter is out there all the time. So I really want to eliminate the problem. I don't want to encourage this guy around. In fact, I want to get rid of him out of my yard and hanging around. But that certainly isn't really grounds to refer him to the police. Right? He hasn't really done anything. It's just a gut feeling I have that I'm uncomfortable with this person around my child.
Well,
so what do I do?
Okay, and that's a really great question. I'm going to tell you a story about, and it's always better by explanation, about something that happened again in my family just last week. I have an 18-year-old stepson who went to 7-Eleven at lunch, and there was a man who made a comment to him about the pants he was wearing. And also, the man was a Caucasian man and had his hands on a 4-year-old African-American kid who clearly didn't look like he was biologically related. And he wasn't touching the kid in a sexual way, but the comment and the way he was talking to my son and the way he was touching this kid bothered my son. And he called me, and he's like, "What do I do?" And he's like, "I have that uh-oh feeling, Robin," and they tease me about that because, you know, he's 18, and that's, you know, my test is if you have uh-oh feelings, the person you and your child need to be away from the uh-oh person. And he's like, "I'm away from the uh-oh guy, but what do I do?" And you know, my instinct was, you know, if I'm following my own advice, I'm saying that we should always call the police. When obviously the crime has been committed, but what about when we think something is suspicious? And so I told him I'd call him right back, and I called my detective, and I said, "Listen, I find this suspicious." And she said, "You know what, Robin, you're absolutely right. You just call and you make a suspicious circumstances report. And you just say, I have something weird and I feel something, and you make the report, and whether it's the police's choice whether they're going to investigate or follow up or whatever, but you get to go to sleep at night and decide, and who knows, maybe that person's wanted. Maybe that person has, you know, victimized 20 other kids that he was gardening for, and they were looking for, you know, someone to identify him or whatever. And a lot of these cases are solved by prior reporting, and so there's no downside to reporting something that's suspicious, other than feeling like you're not giving a person the chance. But at the same time, the real test is if that doesn't feel comfortable, the default should always be to call the police, clearly when there's any sort of crime that's occurred, but at least to have then the conversation with your child, because you don't want to just simply remove someone from the house without any explanation. You want to say to your kid, "You know, I'm this gardener, he's making me feel a little creepy. What do you think?" And many times it's an opportunity to have those safety conversations that make sense. And your kid could say, "Oh, you know what, I'm kind of creeped out by him too." And then maybe the child says, "Yeah, I heard that he's touched so-and-so," or whatever. So can't really know until you have the conversation.
Right. So, I can understand where people would think, "Geez, you know, I really don't want to get involved. If I can just keep him out of my yard, I'm satisfied." But if there is some reason to be concerned and you don't do anything about it, other than worry about yourself and your particular property and child, you may have a bad actor there who is going to be doing something two houses down or whatever. So the prudent thing to do really is, like you say, you can file one of these reports, let the police decide what they want to do with it.
Absolutely.
You know, rather than just sitting on it or deciding on your own that it's not worth it.
Right. I mean, I know. You know, how many people have witnessed car accidents and, like, you know, run the other way because they don't want to, you know, be a witness and then it's subpoenaed and have to be inconvenienced in their life. But, I mean, our society depends on Good Samaritans and the work of our community to observe. And look at some of the high-profile cases. Look at Casey Anthony. Look at, you know, the Chandra Levy with the work of Cheryl McCollum, and people, good folks, good regular everyday citizens, the listeners on the show, the people all around, if it weren't for people who cared, crimes would be unsolved, people would be victimized, and so we should honor those people and take their lead.
Robin, what I'm going to do is, the time is kind of slipping by rapidly here. I want to spend a couple of minutes talking about a couple of the current cases that are in the news. So let me just finish up briefly going over the remaining parts of your book. Part four is reporting sexual abuse. And it gets into what kind of evidence is considered corroboration of child sexual abuse. What are the general stages of crime scene investigation? What happens if there's a sexual assault disclosure during a divorce case? So it gets into a lot of the stuff about if it gets to that stage, what you can do and what you should do. And then it also talks, part five, about going to court and how do you determine whether a child can testify in court, the difference between criminal court, civil court, family court, dependency court. And then on to the final part, part six, healing and moving on. So if someone is unfortunate enough to have to go through this whole thing, you know, and was a victim or the child was a victim, after it's over with, what you can do and how you can get back to your, as you say in question 100, the healing process. So these are all things that, again, in my opinion, it behooves anyone out there with children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, neighbors, what have you, to get this book, read it, and have some idea of what you should be looking for, and if you see it or find it, what you can do about it, and what the steps are in the process. So I highly encourage people to get this book and read it. I want to move on in the last 4 minutes we have to talk about a couple of the ongoing cases. These don't necessarily involve sex crime, but for example, the Kaylee Anthony case, as far as I know, there's no information that she was sexually assaulted, but nonetheless, she was murdered by someone.
By her mother.
Yes. I was being
in my opinion.
Casey. But it's, you know, I mean, there's quite a cast of characters there with... there's been a lot of criticism of Jose Baez. Now, I realize he's an attorney, and maybe it's not good to talk about fellow attorneys, but, you know, inexperience or some of the moves he's made, whether they don't seem to make sense to a lot of observers. And George and Cindy, now that I watched Depo Cam after they had their civil depots in the Zenaida, Zany the Nanny case, and I never, ever would have dared, if I was subpoenaed, to keep telling the lawyer interviewing me or questioning me that if he didn't do this, do that, he had 2 minutes or I was walking out, or if he used a certain word again, I was going to get up and I was going to leave. And that I didn't like his attitude. I didn't like the way the finger he used to put his glasses back up. And I just never, you know, I would look at my attorney, and if he didn't object or whatever, I'd know that I was on the hook and I was going to have to deal with the question as best as I could. And is this odd for people, both of them, Cindy and George, to keep telling these different lawyers that they're walking out and they don't, not going to tolerate hearing certain words used and so on? Or is
well,
this kind of an apparition?
Well, I think all their behavior is an aberration, and there's definitely odd behavior. But it kind of reminds me, for those of you who remember the Charles Manson case, or at least read about it, you know, this one of the reasons that that case was successfully prosecuted was because of the control that Charles Manson had over the you know, his army and his ladies and his followers right there in the courtroom. And it kind of reminds me a little bit of the Anthonys. You can see the control and the behavior and how they may have raised a daughter like they've raised by their behavior in these office buildings of what they're going to do that are not appropriate not what you would expect given the severity of the situation, and also just shows the control and lack of regard and respect for the process that they're going through.
Hey, Robin, they're going to cut us off. I don't know where the time went to, but I want to thank you very, very much for being on tonight.
My pleasure, and thank you for having me.
And I believe we're going to talk to you and Susan on June 3rd on the Juror 13 program.
I'm looking so forward to it, and thank you for all you do. You do a magnificent job.
Thanks, Robin. You have a good night now. Take
thank
care.
You. Okay, bye-bye.
And thanks, everyone who listened. I appreciate it. And our next show will be on May 20th for Juror 13. We're going to be continuing our Children Under Siege theme. And our outside guest will be Heather Steele of the Innocent Justice Foundation. Thank you very much and have a great night.